Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Racism and economic pain. In 2009, those were the two factors that prompted the Department of Homeland Security to issue a report about the threat of right-wing extremism in America. Barack Obama had just become the first black president. The Great Recession was pulling people under. Well, more than a decade later, what are security analysts worried about when it comes to another lasting rise in the threat of domestic terrorism? Racism and economic pain, this time in the form of a president who peddles in division and a pandemic that's wiped away all the economic gains of the past decade. So this hour on Point, we will talk with the DHS analyst who first authored that 2009 report and ask him what he's seeing as America edges towards another election. Well, from 2004 to 2010, Daryl Johnson was that senior domestic terrorism analyst at the DHS Office of Intelligence and Analysis. He later founded DT Analytics, a consulting firm for law enforcement that analyzes domestic terrorism activity. He's also author of the 2019 book, Hateland, A Long, Hard Look at America's Extremist Heart. Daryl Johnson, welcome to On Point. So first of all, let me just ask you, how, as the nation approaches November 2020, how concerned are you that racism and economic pain are inflaming right-wing extremism or even possible domestic terrorism?
I'm very concerned, and we saw the same phenomena happen the last election cycle in 2016. But what makes this election cycle even more dangerous is the fact that we are in the midst of a pandemic, and we've got a couple of new domestic extremist movements that have armed themselves and have mobilized towards action. And I'm talking about the Boogaloo movement.
So the Boogaloo movement. Okay, so you know what, Daryl? I'm going to come back to this, but I just wanted to check with you that sort of the basis of this comparison that we want to draw from you today is a valid one. It sounds like it very much is. So let's go back then to 2009, or actually even before that, I think around 2007. Can you tell us the story of why DHS at that time decided that they needed you to look into the threat of right-wing extremism?
Yeah, so I was actually hired through congressional authority, hiring authorities, which was called Spot Hire Authority. DHS in 2004 saw that they had a blind spot and that no one at the Department of Homeland Security was knowledgeable or an expert in domestic non-Islamic terrorism. So at the time, I was working for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives as their subject matter expert on violent anti-government groups and white supremacy. And so I was hired by DHS to come over and to provide that expertise, as well as assemble a team of analysts to look at this phenomena and to conduct threat assessment on these various movements.
Okay. And then, I believe roughly in January of 2007, you got a phone call. Is that right?
That's right. And so we got a phone call from the U.S. Capitol Police in January of 2007 asking us to monitor internet chatter to see if there would be any threats against an African-American senator, Barack Obama, who was going to announce his presidency or his candidacy for president. And so we opened up a request for information, and we began that internet monitoring effort. And we did that for about a month or so and did not see any threats towards Barack Obama at that time. It was only until the following year when he announced or he won the nomination, the Democratic nomination, that we started to see the threats started rolling in. And there was actually two assassination plots that were thwarted.
Two assassination plots that were thwarted. Wow. Okay. And so then by the time 2009 rolled around and Barack Obama was inaugurated, we also had the Great Recession due to the financial catastrophe triggered late in 2008. So can you tell me more about what your analysis showed about the combination of those two things?
Sure. So when we got that request for information from the Capitol Police, and it got us to thinking, what if an African-American became president? What would that do to the threat landscape here in America? Because at the time, the U.S.'s sole focus for its counterterrorism efforts was to prevent the next 9/11. We were focused more from the outside threats coming in. We weren't looking at the threats within that could pose a national security concern. So we hypothesized that, and I had tasked my analysts to begin collecting information as we were going about our daily activities that would indicate a rise or a resurgence in right-wing extremism and violence from the far right. So we did that all the way through 2007 into 2008, and it was only when Barack Obama actually won the election in November of 2008 is when we started putting pen to paper and writing this assessment. We saw a couple of attacks immediately after the 2008 election. We had an African-American church up in New England that was burned. We also had a neo-Nazi go on a shooting spree in Boston. So we started seeing people being agitated already that early after the election. We also saw an unprecedented growth on a publicly available white supremacist website called Stormfront that at the time had several thousand members, but in the day after the election we saw a few thousand people sign up, the most that we'd ever seen in one day on this website. So we began putting pen to paper, putting the assessment together. We already knew that during economic downturns, there tends to be people, agitated, angry, depressed, looking for answers. And these extremist movements on the far right like to exploit things like economic downturns to recruit people into their various causes and movements. So when we have economic downturns, it creates a pool of potential people who are anti-government or economically desperate or, other people that are just searching for truth, or maybe they've lost a job and they're blaming, foreign outsourcing of jobs or jobs, being shipped overseas. And so they become vulnerable to recruitment, or they outright seek out these extremist beliefs. So we knew that, the economic downturn coupled with an African-American president was kind of the perfect storm for this nightmarish scenario of a resurgence in far-right violence.
So that would logically then, or one could logically presume then, Daryl, that then when your report was completed, and I presume that at the beginning it was meant to be exclusively an internal report, that the Obama administration, namely then Secretary DHS Secretary Janet Napolitano, would have welcomed the findings and the recommendations with open arms.
Yeah, and in fact, she did. Right before the report was released in early April of 2009, I had the privilege of going and giving Janet Napolitano a desk-side briefing on the report's findings, because when she was appointed as the new Homeland Security Secretary, she didn't realize we were already writing this report, and she came to us with three questions. She asked, are we seeing a rise in right-wing extremism? If so, what's causing it? And then the last question was, what are we going to do about it? And we had already, had this assessment in draft and said, well, this answers the secretary's questions, at least the first two. And so I was asked to brief the findings of the assessment, and we invited the FBI to come over and brief what we're going to do about it. The one thing that your listeners need to understand is the Office of Intelligence and Analysis at the Department of Homeland Security, it's part of the intelligence community, but we had limited authorities. We were pretty much we didn't have any investigative authorities. We couldn't, do covert monitoring of the internet. We couldn't do any type of undercover operations. That was the FBI's job to do that. Our job right. was to do what's called strategic analysis, which is looking at the country as a whole, big emerging trends, new movements that are forming, what type of tactics and tradecraft they were using, and to give out kind of policy recommendations.
Point well taken. But to look at those national patterns is obviously a critical exercise. That as you were saying that Secretary Napolitano was she wanted to know what your findings were, and it sounds like she initially received them very well. But then it got leaked. The report got leaked. Okay, and I just want to just play a clip that encapsulates what happened, or the response, once that report got leaked. Here is Fox News anchor David Asman speaking with commentator Andrea Tantaros back in 2009.
Well, Andrea, I'm looking at the report, and it says, among other things, that the federal government is going to begin gathering information on right-wing extremist activity in the United States. Does that mean they're going to be sending spies to these Tea Parties?
I'm not sure about that, but all I know is it is taxpayer money so that Obama and his administration can define an unreasonable enemy. I mean, think about it, David. Obama does not have an unreasonable enemy, and he would love for nothing more. I mean, the Clintons, they always had an unreasonable enemy, and that was the vast right-wing conspiracy.
Well, Daryl, we've just got 30 seconds before we have to take our first break here, but is it fair to categorize the blowback as more of a hurricane?
Certainly, and that's something that we never anticipated was the level of political backlash that this report received. Things being taken out of context, misconstrued, put into basically weaponizing my report against the new elected administration.
Well, we are talking with Daryl Johnson. He's a former senior domestic terrorism analyst at the Department of Homeland Security. It's a position he held for several years, but then left following this report that he issued. We're going to talk more about what he's learned since then about right-wing extremism in America as we head towards the 2020 election. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Daryl Johnson. He is founder of DT Analytics, a consulting firm for law enforcement that analyzes domestic terrorism activity. And between 2004 to 2010, he was the senior domestic terrorism analyst at DHS's Office of Intelligence and Analysis. And in 2009, he authored a report warning about the rise of far-right-wing extremism and domestic terrorism in the wake of the Great Recession and the election of President Barack Obama. So we're talking with Daryl to see what he thinks has changed or hasn't changed as we approach the 2020 election. Now, Daryl, I just wanted to, before the break, we were talking about the blowback that your office received when this 2009 report was leaked. Can you tell us what it was like in those first couple of days when you walked into work? I mean, was it chaos? How much pressure were you under?
Yeah, so after briefing Janet Napolitano on the findings and getting positive feedback from not only her but my whole entire management chain, I went home for the weekend feeling really good that we had done something of great service to the nation and sent out this prescient warning to our policymakers as well as to the local and state police about this emerging threat that was on the horizon. And I was actually helping the Boy Scouts with a fundraiser when I was listening to the radio and heard on the noon news hour that this new DHS report had been issued, and it was warning against this rise of right-wing extremism. I didn't realize until Monday when I came into the office that the conservative media had politicized my report. And I came into utter chaos in the office. Our acting undersecretary for intelligence was receiving phone calls from congressional staffers demanding the sourcing into the document and how we came up with this these findings and why we were using the term right-wing extremism. We were getting bombarded at the operations center from concerned citizens that had been fed misinformation by Fox News and the 700 Club and other Rush Limbaugh and others. And so they got the operations center's phone number and did a phone blitz, clogging up the lines. We had FOIA requests that came in later from concerned citizens and organizations. There was even a bogus lawsuit filed by some attorney up in Michigan saying that we had slandered conservatives or something. So it was quite the deal, and it lasted for about a month.
A month. I suppose in modern parlance we would say that the work got canceled.
Yeah, so we were distracted initially with responding to all this FOIA requests, congressional inquiries, trying to formulate a strategy. We were immediately cut out of the loop by DHS leadership. They never came to us to ask for counter talking points for a press release or anything, which told me that they had already concocted a plan or some sort of misinformation campaign, which they later said that a rogue analyst in DHS had somehow written this report and sent it out without authorization. That was the story that they put out, which was totally untrue.
Now, so one of the aspects of your report that I think many conservatives were profoundly focused on was the report warned about the possibility of returning military veterans being recruited into these far right-wing movements that could lead to potential a rise in domestic terrorism. Now, that is one of the things that ultimately you would think that the Obama administration would have stood up for you, that the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security would have stood up for one of her own analysts, and yet that did not happen. I mean, Secretary Napolitano retracted the document and then even apologized to veterans as well, and the branch of the extremism and radicalization branch, if I remember correctly, Daryl, that was basically just quietly dismantled.
Yeah. So the harmful effects of how the leak and the criticism and how Homeland Security and the Obama administration failed to rebut the criticism is not only did it send a chilling effect throughout the intelligence and law enforcement communities and showing that you weren't going to get support from your leadership if you came under attack from conservatives or political groups or what have you, that there was going to be hell to pay if you wrote about this subject. People's jobs were threatened. People were reassigned different work. We were retaliated against, essentially, by our management team. So not only did it send a chilling effect, but what happened is those lies and mischaracterizations of the report that it was slandering conservatives and that we were spying on people that were opposed to immigration and abortion, things like this, it allowed that misinformation to become truth because nobody refuted it. And so I feel that there's some people that actually became radicalized because the Department of Homeland Security didn't, you know, quell the criticism.
What do you mean by that? Radicalize whom?
Far-right extremists. So when you have conservatives saying that we're spying on conservatives and that we're, you know, going to be monitoring people that opposed immigration and abortion, people get upset about that, obviously. But that wasn't the truth. That was basically a definition taken out of context that was buried in a footnote that was trying to give a wide look at the type of issues as well as the type of movements we were talking about when we said right-wing extremism. So the three criticisms from that report was the term right-wing extremism. They felt that that was a term that was slandering conservatives. However, that's a legitimate terminology that's used in the counterterrorism lexicon. The FBI had used it for decades, and nobody criticized it. The definition that was vague, we basically said right-wing extremism is broken into movements that are hate-oriented and anti-government and could focus on single issues such as abortion, immigration, and taxation. And we had to have such a broad definition because that's the wide swath of violent extremist groups we were talking about. And we're talking about people not only who carry out violence, but those that support the violence by making calls for violence or donating money to organizations that are linked to violence or providing safe haven to hardened criminals or terrorists. So it's not just the operatives, it's the whole network of people that support the terrorism. And then the last thing was the military veterans criticism. And, the American Legion particularly objected and had sent a letter to Homeland Security. In hindsight, I could have maybe used a better term instead of saying disgruntled military veterans. I could have just said, recruitment of veterans. But it's been established that there's been trends in the past where when veterans come back from wars and they're trying to reacclimate into society and there's an economic downturn and some of them might be suffering from PTSD and other adverse effects of being in war zones. These people have been targeted by white supremacists and militia groups, bringing them in to boost the violent capabilities of these movements and also to provide leadership roles.
Well, just to emphasize something, Daryl, in terms of how the government itself exacerbated this problem. I just want to be clear on something. So you got that first call in 2007. So this would have been under the aegis of the George W. Bush administration. So a Republican administration. Then the report was published under a Democratic administration. You get extreme pushback from the Republican Party, from conservatives as well. But then that very same Democratic administration sort of acquiesced under that pushback, dismantled the extremism and radicalization branch, and here we are. So has DHS since then, since that 2009-2010 period, rebuilt its interest and capacity to closely monitor right-wing extremist groups in America?
No. And they've made kind of a half-hearted effort back in 2015. They had a couple of contractors that tried to write a few reports. But what happened in the aftermath of this leak and the political blowback is DHS as an organization made a decision that this was a highly politicized subject. They got all this scrutiny. Their budget was threatened. People's jobs were reassigned. Some people basically were forced out. And so they sent that message that they're not willing to take the risk for this type of political blowback. And so we now have a huge intelligence gap for the past 10 years as this movement has continued to grow year after year. And I'm afraid that we've reached a tipping point where this has become the new normal.
The new normal. Right-wing extremism?
violent right-wing extremism.
Okay. Well, so there's bigger context here as well, because, Daryl, as you know, in 2006, a couple of years earlier, the FBI had released an internal report raising concerns about right-wing extremists or right-wing extremism in law enforcement or the attempt to recruit law enforcement officers. We're going to talk a little bit more about that report in a few minutes here. But obviously right now, since once again there is national attention being paid to right-wing extremism, to how policing is done. And you mentioned, for example, these emergent violent movements like the Boogaloo Boys. I just want to play a little bit of tape here because earlier this month on this program, Howard University civil rights lawyer Justin Hansford came on to talk about the Boogaloo Boys. They are an extremist movement. And here's Hansford describing his experience seeing right-wing extremist counter-protesters during the mass demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri.
Well, I'll tell you, in Ferguson, when the Oath Keepers came to protests, they were friends with the police, and it's something that's been an ongoing problem. We need protection from these groups, and that should be the focus, and I worry about the focus of law enforcement being elsewhere and really focusing antagonism on protesters instead of these types of groups.
So that's Justin Hansford, a Howard University civil rights lawyer. Daryl, I wanted to ask you, you talked about a tipping point. Is part of why we're at this tipping point the fact that some of these right-wing extremist groups now, instead of finding government as the enemy, may find a friend in government, because we have a president who only under extreme duress will disavow right-wing extremism in this country?
Right. So the reason why we've reached this tipping point is that government has neglected this issue, has not made it a priority, has even hid from it and avoided it for the past 10 years. So we've had 10 years of unprecedented growth. Each year, these movements, we're talking about, you know, various white supremacist movements, anti-government groups, militia extremists, sovereign citizens. Year after year, they've gained new recruits. More people get radicalized. We have violent attacks. And so the momentum has grown year after year. We've neglected this problem for so long. It's going to take years for us to stop. If we decided today and had, you know, the top administration officials and a good strategy, and we did a full court press on this problem, it'll still take years to slow the momentum of these violent hate and anti-government groups. We also have a current administration right now that's actually fueling this. And this is the first time I've ever seen these types of movements flourish under a Republican administration. Okay, typically these groups flourish under Democratic administrations because they're fearful of their gun rights being infringed upon, or they're afraid of minority rights being expanded, or immigration being loosened. Typically under Republican administrations, they don't have to worry about that, but yet this current administration fuels these movements through their rhetoric and even their actions. You know, pushing policies like building a border wall, banning Muslims from coming into the country, labeling immigrants seeking asylum as invaders. These are terms and positions that I saw on neo-Nazi and KKK websites 10 to 15 years ago, and now the President of the United States is endorsing these things as policy. So, you know, the administration, through its lack of action and calling out this threat, has actually emboldened it and enabled it and given them a permissive environment to operate. So it's a combination of a variety of things that's led us to this tipping point.
Mm. Daryl, if you're still monitoring right-wing extremism in the United States through your private company here, are you concerned about what might happen between now and November as that further inflaming happens the closer we get to the election? Are you seeing a change in the pattern of chatter or any flags that are being raised in your analysis?
Yes. couple of things I'll mention. Two other new movements that have emerged since my report of 09 are the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters. And the little clip you played about the Ferguson riots and how the Oath Keepers were kind of coddling with law enforcement, this problem of law enforcement and ties to extremism, in my opinion, because of Oath Keepers and Three Percenters, has grown tenfold since that 2006 FBI report. So that's one area of concern. And then we've got other movements like the Boogaloo movement that want to hasten a civil war in this country. These people already believe we're in a rhetorical civil war, but they've been actually preparing and planning for an actual physical civil war. They've been stockpiling weapons and ammunition. And with the current pandemic and, you know, the government's policies of social distancing and self-quarantine and things like this, these people are getting agitated not only because of the isolation of self-quarantine, but they feel that the government isn't, you know, taking away their rights by implementing these policies. And so, you know, we're kind of in this mix of, you know, these groups are actively planning and plotting for a civil war. They're getting more paranoid. Fear has permeated these movements even more because of the pandemic. So we're in a real bad situation right now.
Well, Daryl Johnson, stand by for just a moment. Daryl was an analyst at the Department of Homeland Security. A decade ago, he authored a report warning about right-wing extremism and domestic terrorism in this country. And as you hear, we are asking him if his concerns are even greater now. We'll talk a little bit more about this question of law enforcement when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about schools again. It's a huge issue. We're going to try and take multiple swings at it. So tomorrow, we're going to take a look at how schools internationally in several other countries that have are trying to work their way out of this pandemic, how they have opened or reopened their schools, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and what ideas could we import realistically here into the United States. So we want to know if you listen internationally or if you have friends or who are abroad, what stories have you heard about efforts to reopen schools across our pandemic-ridden world? If you've heard from family or friends, let us know. We're at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for the show tomorrow. Today, we are talking with Daryl Johnson. He is the owner of DT Analytics. It's a consulting firm for law enforcement that analyzes domestic terrorist activity. He spent years as a senior domestic terrorism analyst at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And in 2009, he issued a report warning about a precipitous rise in right-wing extremism in this country. That report received heavy criticism from conservatives and also wasn't defended by the Obama administration. We're talking with Daryl today to see if he thinks anything has changed. And thus far, he's been telling us that, yes, it has. It's just gotten worse. Well, we want to drill down a little bit more into this question of extremism in law enforcement, because there's a whole spectrum of concerns that are worthy of examination here. So let's go to St. Louis for a moment, because in St. Louis, last year, a December 2019 report found a large number of St. Louis police officers had been posting racism or hateful comments online. Here's a news report from CBS affiliate KMOV in St. Louis reporting on the dismissal of two police officers who posted this kind of content online.
Tonight, two St. Louis police officers are no longer with the department. Both have been fired because of social media profiles. Facebook posts from officers Thomas Mabry and Ronald Hasty were flagged by the Plainview Project. A two-year review found messages that celebrated roughing up protesters, shooting criminals, and expressing disgust for Islam.
So that's a report from December of 2019. Now, we should also note that at least 60 officers were found to have posted this content in the St. Louis Police Department. And the St. Louis Circuit Attorney, so concerned about this, that she has banned a number of officers from even bringing cases to her office or issuing warrants because of their racist content online. So let's turn now to Detective Sergeant Heather Taylor. She's president of the Ethical Society of Police, which represents many black officers in the St. Louis region. She's a night watch homicide sergeant with the St. Louis Metro Police Department. Detective Sergeant Taylor, welcome to the program.
Hello.
So first of all, can you tell me a little bit about what you have seen in the department? Go ahead.
I think that there have been examples. We had warning signs for years that we had officers who were subscribing to extreme views, who had extreme views on race. We have a webpage called, we had a webpage called Cop Talk. And before smartphones, you logged in to your department email through this Cop Talk webpage, which is associated with the St. Louis Police Association, Police Officers Association. And when you would log into this webpage, you scroll down a little bit and you would see some of the most vile and racist content. And you would see things like African Americans being referred to as monkeys, apes, the N-word being used, people in our community being referred to as animals. And this was before Michael Brown was killed. And our department allowed us to log in through this webpage to get to your email. And we saw it. We've had officers for years who'd used the N-word, and later on in their career, they're placed in specialized units. And it's essentially a promotion, more pay after using the N-word. And we've seen it within our police department and the acceptance of these extreme views that were there. And I won't say, I will not subscribe to that everyone in law enforcement who is a white officer is a white nationalist, a white supremacist. That's not, they aren't. We have pockets of people in law enforcement who have been allowed to exist and continue these beliefs without being checked or terminated for these views. So when Plainview came about and you had one of the names mentioned in the or the CBS article that you just played, that piece was Sergeant Ron Hasty. Well, Sergeant Ron Hasty's profile picture says Ron Nighthawk, and Nighthawk is a security position in the Klan. And you had someone just in Plainview, that had this Facebook page name, who had these extreme views. You had Detective Mabry, who had these extreme views, who was friends with other officers. That's what's is so insane, is that that culture of silence that allowed these guys to function as law enforcement officers making decisions of freedom. It's horrifying.
Well, Detective Sergeant, if I may, you heard Daryl Johnson a couple of minutes ago say that right-wing extremist groups are growing, that we have new movements that are catering specifically to law enforcement, possibly even recruiting from law enforcement. I mean, have you seen, do you know if there's any evidence of that in your department?
I wouldn't be surprised by it. I don't think most people were surprised by the Plainview Project. We weren't surprised by some of the names that were on there. And with this movement, with the Boogaloo Boys, they are extreme. You have these extreme views, but we knew about some of this in 2006 when the FBI, with the redacted report about white supremacists infiltrating law enforcement and recruiting law enforcement personnel. We knew this then, so I'm not shocked by it. Do I think that there, can I give you a number on that? I think that no number really matters, because it's one is enough, two is enough. The destruction that one person with these views can do, can wreak on a community, especially a community of color, a poor community, is enough to last a lifetime. I do believe that there are pockets of people who are, and I'm not shocked by any of this happening. And I don't think most people within our police department are shocked by this, especially, and I am also the president of the Ethical Society of Police, which is mostly minority police association. So we have these mostly African-American members who weren't really shocked by any of this, not shocked by the stories of extreme views. We most of us who have 20 plus years, like myself, lived through cop talk, have been repeatedly complaining about officers with extreme views on white supremacy, racist posting, LGBTQ, that have targeted people repeatedly. And
yeah. Well, so Detective Sergeant Taylor, this is both chilling and eye-opening. And Daryl Johnson, hang on here for just a second, because this FBI report from 2006 has actually come up a couple of times in our conversation. And I want to see if there's been a little bit of forward movement on that. So joining us now from Washington is Representative Norma Torres. She's a Democratic representative for California's 35th Congressional District. Now, last month, she and 27 lawmakers requested that the DOJ release the full contents of this 2006 FBI report. The report was titled White Supremacist Infiltration of Law Enforcement, and it was released in a heavily redacted version. They're asking it to be released in full. Representative Torres, welcome to you.
Great to be with all of you, Meghna, today.
So first of all, just tell me a little bit more. Has the Department of Justice responded to your request to fully release this 06 FBI report?
Currently, they have not, which is really unfortunate. You know, we are working. We're in the process right now of working around the issues of police brutality and to try to bring about some justice and sanity back into our communities. Systematic racism has plagued this nation from its very start. And if we fall short right now, our failings will be felt for generations. So, you know, it's critically important that we fully know what is in that report that was written in 2006. And I'm so glad that Mr. Johnson is on the phone with us, because he warned us about the very same threat, the fact that many of the people who were identified in 2006 could be in leadership positions. Let's face it, these could be the recruiters out there in charge of hiring, you know, our future police officers. And the fact that, you know, Congress has been denied this information for all of these years, 14 years to be exact, you know, to me is criminal in its face.
Well, Representative, if I may, I just want to turn back to Daryl Johnson for a second here, because the redacted version of this FBI report, Daryl has a couple of takeaways that are there in plain print, that the primary threat from infiltration or recruitment arises in the areas of intelligence collection, which can lead to investigative breaches and jeopardize the safety of law enforcement personnel and sources themselves. And it also says that white supremacist presence amongst law enforcement is a concern due to the access and power they possess that could be dangerous and harmful to elected officials or protected persons whom they are, who the white supremacists see as a target for violence. Why can you explain to me at all, Daryl, why the government would resist releasing the details, the full details of a report that was written in order to protect law enforcement and members of the government themselves?
Yeah, so for a long time, these people have hid behind the First Amendment, saying that they have the right to hate. And that's true. However, when you're trying to build public trust and have an agency that may investigate fellow members of your hate group, you pose a operational security concern. You're an insider, potential insider threat. I don't think anyone that belongs to a militia group or a white supremacy group should be in a law enforcement position. And the shocking thing is I actually worked on an article with Reveal News last year where we identified over 100 police officers who actively flaunted on their social media their extremist affiliations, and none of the internal affairs or inspector general offices were open to doing any type of administrative action against these individuals because they said it was their First Amendment right.
To be part of a group. But yep. Should they be in uniform?
Exactly. And for the counterintelligence concerns, the insider threat concerns, operational security concerns, these things were raised in this FBI memo. And, you know, that doesn't instill trust in the police department when you have active members of militia groups and hate groups in your among the ranks.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left to go. So, Detective Sergeant Taylor, let me turn back to you here for a second. You know, as a serving officer right now, who, by the way, I want to just express my gratitude for your courage in speaking plainly about this and what you've seen in your own department. Just how do we begin to get a handle on this problem? What would you recommend that is done?
On the front end, you don't hire people who have these extreme views. Because these same people, like the Boogaloo Boys, are killing law enforcement. It just seems like common sense that you do better background checks. And so on the back end, what we have is multi-million-dollar lawsuits and payouts. When we hire people with extreme views on minorities, with extreme views on LGBTQ, all these people that have these extreme views, or a lot of times it comes out, and it comes out on the back end where you have people who are murdered by law enforcement, who are wrongfully arrested by law enforcement, and you have all these things that we could resolve on the front end of it by doing better background checks of people we're hiring. Spend a little more time with these background checks. And before you give them the powers of arrest and the powers to take away freedom.
Mm. Representative Torres, we've just got a couple of seconds left. I wonder, you're pushing to get this 2006 FBI report fully released, but don't we already know enough about reasons to be concerned? And if so, like, what is there anything that can be done, say, from the congressional level?
Absolutely. We know enough, and that is why the Justice and Policing Act is so important. You know, it has on there an issue that I worked on very closely, and that's the decertification of police officers. We need to ensure that police departments are able to decertify, you know, problem officers. But more importantly, last week, I successfully included language in the Commerce, Justice, and Science Appropriations Bill that requires the Justice Department to update the Committee on White Supremacist Infiltration and the steps that they've taken to address it. So it's a huge victory. It's a step in the right direction. We do know enough, you know, to ensure that we get the Justice and Policing Act passed now.
Right. And then, as Daryl's been talking to us, beyond policing as well, he remains profoundly concerned about white supremacy and far-right right-wing extremism as we head towards that November 2020 election. So Representative Norma Torres, Detective Sergeant Heather Taylor, and Daryl Johnson. Thank you to the three of you so very much for joining us today. And by the way, at onpointradio.org, we've got links to all the reports we've been talking about this hour, so check it out. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.